universities, shouting Palestine shall be free from the river to the sea, and all the kind of almost pro-Hamas, pro-Hezbollah demos, I would think, hey, hold on, the game's not up, is it?
No, it's been a very successful strategy because, let's face it, Israel has the last 2 years have been incredibly successful for Israel. They've taken Hamas apart. They have taken Hezbollah apart. The threat that was they faced from Syria has gone. They have absolutely cowed Iran and set back their nuclear program several years at least. That's on the foreign front, though. If you look on the different sort of soft power front, they are reeling. Public opinion has turned against them in many parts of the world. They've had a very successful PR campaign. You and I are partially on the same page, I can tell with our language. On those demonstrations today, I reluctantly think that these people have the right to demonstrate and wearing their romantic cosplaying costumes. But they're free to demonstrate how cold they are, how heartless they are, particularly on this day.
Indeed.
And they're free to remain ignorant.
Tim, I'm sorry, we're going to have to wrap. We've run out of time. But I thank you, and I'll be back here on Times Radio 1 p.m. tomorrow. It's now Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
Across the UK, on DAB, online, and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you, Andrew. Andrew back with the Times at 1 on Wednesday here on Times Radio. It is 2 o'clock, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover until 4.
And coming up in those 2 hours, as today marks the second anniversary of the October the 7th attacks, we'll talk to a man whose sister and nieces were killed that day. We're going to touch base at the Tory conference. Robert Jenrick pulled a wig from a box. We'll try and explain why. Also, why Spain is trying to end the UK's love affair with Magaluf. Does anybody fancy the Basque Country instead? We're going to hear from a listener who got in touch with us about the tension being created in her community by flags. And after 3:30, podcaster, journalist and novelist Elizabeth Day joins us live in the studio. Now let's get the news at 2. Here's James Kitchen.
Thank you, Jane. Good afternoon. Sirens have sounded in Tel Aviv to mark 2 years since the October 7th attacks, in which about 1,200 Israelis were killed and 251 others taken hostage. Indirect talks between Israel and Hamas aimed at securing a deal to end the war in Gaza are continuing in Egypt. The US President Donald Trump has told reporters that tremendous progress is being made. The Times' World Affairs editor, Catherine Philp, who's in Jerusalem, says Israelis are not necessarily united on this day.
There is even a split within the hostage families themselves about whether the military response to Hamas is the correct one or not. But I will say that the majority of the hostages' families are calling for an immediate end and a ceasefire. And those calls are very live still in Tel Aviv, where there is a mixture of solemnity but also protest.
Meanwhile, more than a dozen protests against the conflict in Gaza are to take place at UK universities this afternoon. Sir Keir Starmer has urged students not to attend the rallies, calling them un-British. The Prime Minister warned too many previous demos have turned into forums for hate and anti-Semitism. The Justice Secretary, David Lammy, has accused his Conservative counterpart of attacking British values over plans for ministers to appoint judges. Robert Jenrick also promised to abolish the Sentencing Council if his party returns to power. He's been speaking at the Conservative conference in Manchester.
Let's fight for a better future. Let's build this new order. Let's take our country back. Thank you, conference. Thank you.
Mr. Lammy says the independence of judges is not optional. Meanwhile, Nigel Farage claims the Conservative Party is finished after 20 of its councillors defected to Reform UK. The Tories still have more than 4,000 councillors, while Reform has fewer than 900. Speaking to Times Radio, the Shadow Scotland Secretary Andrew Bowie insisted the party is looking forward.
I fundamentally believe that these few days in Manchester are sowing the seeds of our recovery. We are rebuilding to a point of strength, and we are ready to fight and indeed win the next general election when it comes. So I bid them farewell. It is with sadness that I do so. I think they're wrong, but we move on.
Elsewhere, 46 people have been arrested in the UK's largest ever crackdown on the theft of mobile phones. Police say they've disrupted a network suspected of smuggling 40,000 devices from the UK to China in the last year. It could account for 40% of London's stolen phones. The Met Police Commissioner, Sir Mark Rowley, says serious organised crime gangs are behind the thefts.
They chase the money, and because there's so much money in this, because of the values of phones and the way international organised crime are exploiting it, they're moving away, in some cases, from drug dealing to stealing mobile phones.
And British troops are on heightened alert after intruders cut a wire fence and broke into a military barracks in Wiltshire. Criminals were able to sneak into Larkhill Camp in daylight on Saturday and steal fuel from a tanker belonging to a civilian contractor. The incident has raised further concerns about security at military bases following a breach at RAF Bryce Norton in June. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on the Times radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB, online, and on your smart speaker. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms.
Good afternoon. Hope you're fit and well this Tuesday. We're here until 4 o'clock this afternoon, and today, on the anniversary of the Hamas attack on Israel, we're going to talk to a man called Steve Brisley, whose sister and nieces were killed and whose brother-in-law was taken hostage. He was released earlier this year, and he is, well, I suppose you could loosely say he's on the road to recovery, but what an ordeal that man has been through. Steve Brisley in the second hour of our programme today. Now, the latest from the Tory conference as well, of course, Robert Jenrick has said he wants to crack down on what he calls a pro-immigration bias in the judiciary, and he did do something a little bit weird with a legal wig. The authorities...
I think you've made that sound far more exciting than it is.
You're actually right there. But look, we're trying to encourage listeners. We don't want to put anybody off. The authorities in Spain want British visitors, that's us, to be more adventurous, get off the beaten path. This could well be their polite way of telling us to stop getting tanked up in their city centres. The Nobel Prize for Physics has been awarded to three men who did breakthrough work in a series of experiments on electrical circuits back in the 1980s. All this will be fully explained by our resident genius, Time science writer Tom Whipple. And in health news with Dr. Rachel Ward, who qualifies for a free COVID jab? The rules have been changed, and Dr. Rachel will put us all in the picture a little bit later. And our big guest after 3:30 is
Elizabeth Day. So we know her as a novelist, we know her as a podcaster. Many people know her as somebody who has really spoken out about a rather heartbreaking fertility journey. She is also the very proud owner of a delicious ginger cat. Do you need me to go on? This is a woman who is right at the top of her game, and her latest novel, called One of Us, Jane and I Have Really Loved. I've put a cliche on the back of the book. I think it really is.
What have you said?
I've said unputdownable and really cracking, and I apologise for that. But again, I don't, because it is true. It's just I could have thought of a better way of putting it. Other people did. But we've loved it, haven't we? Because it's got good characters in it. It's quite satirical about the Bullingdon set, really. Yeah.
And there are also some good lines about male podcasters.
It's made us chortle that along
made,
the
that,
way.
That really made me laugh.
Yeah.
I mean, unputdownable.
That's terrible.
You're a barefaced liar. You've literally just put it down on the desk.
Yep. So we are doing Elizabeth Day after 3:30. Any questions that you have for her, it's 0333 003 2353. We are Jane and Fee at times.radio. If the email is easier, we welcome all of your comments, all of your thoughts. Kind of all of them, but you know what I mean.
Now, we're going to go to the Tory conference in a moment. First, though, the most read stories on the Times website this afternoon. At number three, unadventurous husbands, young kids, why women go solo. This is about the rise of women choosing to travel on their own. The second most read story is security breach at army camp as fences cut and fuel stolen. British troops have been told to be on high alert after the break-in and theft at Larkhill Camp. And the most read piece on the Times website right now is student protest live. Keir Starmer warns of total loss of humanity. There are some pro-Palestinian protests scheduled at British universities on campuses and indeed through the City of London today. And they start actually around now. We will keep an eye on that between now and 4 o'clock. All of these articles on thetimes.com. You will need your digital subscription. And why not get one if you don't have one now? Go to thetimes.com www.tory.uk/subscribe.
Let's start with the Tory party conference, though, where Kemi Badenoch has defended her leadership after a poll found that half of her members think that she shouldn't lead the Tories into the next election. The Conservative leader also told Times Radio there'd be no pact with Reform UK, also supported by her members. Let's talk all of this through with Chris Hopkins, who's political research director at Savanta. A very good afternoon from us, Chris.
Afternoon.
Let's start with a statement from Kemi Badenoch. No pact, no alignment with Nigel Farage. She made it as part of the interview that she did with Stig Abel this morning for Times Radio, in which she discussed why her right wing, what I knew I couldn't do it, her right wing rivals are surging. Let's have a listen.
Reform has a lot less baggage, got, you know, virtually no baggage. Nigel Farage has reinvented himself. You know, he went to the jungle. Lots of people who'd never heard of him suddenly just saw, you know, a regular guy.
Maybe you should do that. Would you be willing to go on
I'm celebrity? Not going to the jungle.
Just want to clarify that. Can you imagine an alliance with Reform? You'll have seen the polling at this conference. Your members, by 2-1, 64% of them think there should be some form of electoral alliance. We've had Jacob Rees-Mogg on this programme saying you can't split the right and win an election. Would you ever do any form of a deal with Reform?
Well, I'm not splitting the right. There is no deal to be done with Reform. They want to increase welfare. This conference is about living within our means. That's how we get a stronger economy. They want to nationalise. What kind of alliance are we having with them? The only thing that they have in common with us really is around immigration. Yeah. We know that we need stronger borders, but we've got a plan that will work.
Well, Chris, what do you think? Is that a sustainable position?
I mean, I think if you're the Conservative Party, who historically have positioned themselves as the natural party of government, the idea of doing any form of election pact or alliance just feels completely crazy, to be honest. And I think that it makes perfect sense for Kemi Badenoch, you know, 3.5 to 4 years away from a general election, to be saying what she has said. That said, at the minute, you know, the right is split, and it does seem, from the polling, that there is a really kind of narrow path to any sort of Conservative recovery at the moment. One would think that if they are to recover, they will eat into Reform UK's vote share, more so than any other party, but that would only benefit the Labour Party, frankly. So, you know, it is a really difficult path for the Conservatives at the minute, but they are so far from recovery, especially compared to how they performed in the general election less than 2 years ago.
You join us from the conference. What have you made of it? Tell us about the atmosphere and what people have been saying when the microphones aren't on.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty dead, to be honest. I think of the four Conservative conferences that I've been to now, this is considerably the least busy. That said, I don't think the atmosphere is particularly bad, but I guess from the activist point of view, those that have turned up, they are, by definition, the fact that they're here, more enthusiastic than those that have chosen to stay away. So I don't think the atmosphere is bad, but compared to the other Conservative conferences that I've been to in a professional capacity as a pollster, and this is to some extent a qualitative exercise, just trying to read the mood. It's not really very busy at all, and it's been pretty dead today. It feels like a lot of people have chosen to go home early.
Right, well, thank goodness you haven't. Stay where you are, Chris. Take a later train. Is it possible to have a serious conversation with anybody at the conference at the moment about the future of the Conservative Party without having that conversation about where it lies in relation to Reform?
I mean, I think obviously historically governments or political parties have won elections from the centre. That said, you know, the Conservatives know and they understand that a lot of the votes that they have lost have gone to the right and to Reform, and that's partly due to their pretty terrible track record as far as the public are concerned in government. So, you know, I guess the easy route, the easy answer would be to go after those voters. That said, all of the polling that we've conducted on Reform voters, and I think it's not just Savanta, it's across most pollsters, just show that Reform voters are pretty sticky. They don't feel particularly like moving. Ultimately, they have lost the trust of the Conservative Party, and those that have also moved from Labour to Reform have lost the trust of the Labour Party in the last year as well. And they're, at the minute, they don't really feel like shifting. I think given the low level of trust in the two major parties, you know, the alternatives, including Reform UK primarily, but also the Liberal Democrats and also on the left, the Green Party, they've just been de-risked. And I think if the public, you know, think, you know, when push comes to shove at election time, I think that's the main question that we get asked at the minute. You know, what will actually happen in 3 years? Will the voters that are saying they're going to vote for reform at the minute as some sort of protest, will they get cold feet and just lump for the two main parties? And I think if there's ever going to be a real shift in British politics and they don't go home and they do end up voting for an alternative, it does feel like this is it at the minute.
Yeah, I mean, 3 years is a century in domestic politics, so we're a long way off yet, aren't we, Chris? Let's talk about pensions, because all the political parties need to talk about pensions. The triple lock increases state pensions by any combination, the highest of wage growth, isn't it, inflation or 2.5%. Of course, there are suggestions that it's increasingly unaffordable, and of course, Kemi Badenoch was going to be asked about it. This was her response.
The pension triple lock is a Conservative policy. It is one we stand by because we believe that people who have contributed, those who pay in, should get something out. So that is a principle that we believe in.
So you'll never recoil from that?
It is our policy. We brought it in. We haven't always had a pension triple lock in this country, but the acute problem we have is around welfare and work. If we had lots of more people in work, we had 1 million leave work after COVID. Every day, between 3,000 to 5,000 people are signing on out of work benefits. This is an out of control situation. If we sort that and we get those people off benefits and into work, we'll grow our economy and we won't need to worry about the triple lock.
So you think you can get to a point? We had an expert on who said in 11 years' time we're going to run out of money to pay for the state pension.
I believe that if we want to grow our economy, getting people work is the place to start.
Richard Fuller, who is the Shadow Chief Secretary of the Treasury, said here at a fringe event that Britain could restrict the state pension for those who haven't got their savings through their own retirement account, a means-tested state pension.
This is not something that is Conservative Party policy.
Why did he say that?
Because we have free debate in this. We're not a Stalinist party. I believe that we should hear what everyone has to say. But just because people are expressing opinions doesn't mean that they are party policy.
It's a particularly difficult one, isn't it, for the Conservative Party, Chris, because pensioners are incredibly important to the Tory back base, really, aren't they? When you do your polling, what else can you tell us about the future of the triple lock?
Yeah, I mean, I think politicians broadly on the triple lock, on all sides of the divide, really, are always going to be caught between a rock and a hard place. I think that it is why the acknowledge that economically the triple lock is unsustainable. I think increasing numbers of conservative-leaning think tanks are saying the same. Well, that is only going to put pressure on the Conservative Party policy in the long run, but ultimately it is going to be an unpopular decision. And we saw that with the Labour Party, this time last year when they started to make changes to winter fuel payments. And we saw that although I think the Labour Party believed at the time that that was the right decision, it wasn't a very popular one. I guess at least the Labour Party had, in theory, a large parliament majority to be the buffer for that, but some might say that that was the beginning of their public opinion decline, and ultimately that is going to be the risk for any party that risks doing anything with the triple lock in the long run.
Yeah, but I mean, they've got to do something right at the beginning of a term, haven't they? That's exactly what the Labour Party was trying to do, to make the most of the fact that they had a huge majority. They were fresh in power. They thought that they'd be able to do it, and it backfired, as you say. But do you think that there's a way of selling it where it is sold as a much more hypothecated savings? So you actually go to the electorate and say, yes, we are going to take something away from pensioners, but we are directly going to give it to the younger voter. So in terms of balancing your base, you do manage to really get something from it. It's not just a loss.
Yeah, look, I mean, I'm not a communication specialist nor an election strategist, but I think that would be, I mean, that feels to me the sensible solution.
Chris.
I think even, even the Labour Party policy of winter fuel payments ended up being a poorly communicated rationale for doing it. And I think ultimately that was the undoing of it. And then, generally the public don't mind U-turns, but I think that U-turn in particular was particularly damaging for the Labour Party.
Yeah, they didn't really get away with it, did they?
No, they didn't.
Let's talk about Kemi Badenoch's great rival, Robert Jenrick, Bobby J. He's had a slightly quieter conference, I think, than some people might have imagined, but he has been speaking today and he's had a prop with him. It is a wig. Here we go.
You might be wondering, what have I got in this box? Well, don't worry. I'm not about to do a Michael Fabricant tribute act. This is actually serious. For those of you at the back of the room who can't see, I have here
a judge's wig. It's something we should all respect and revere.
Right. I mean, I don't know whether you saw this happening live, but it may have lost a little bit in translation onto the radio, Chris. Props are a little bit difficult to pull off, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that Shadow Justice Secretary conference speeches tend to cut through to the public. But obviously, you know, Robert Jemrick is a pretty high-profile Conservative politician as they go at the moment. And it did seem like a relatively wide-ranging speech for a Shadow Justice Secretary. Obviously, he is positioning himself. Potentially, as you said, he's had a reasonably quiet conference and a pretty loyal conference. I wonder if he saw how Andy Burnham's interventions ahead of the Labour conference tended to backfire and has chosen to keep a lower profile. But maybe he's also playing the longer game. I think the danger for the Conservative Party with Robert Jemrick potentially waiting in the wings is that it just feels like another attempt to sort of out-reform reform, out-Farage Farage, and ultimately no one is going to be able to do that better than Nigel Farage himself. And I do wonder if the Conservative strategy perhaps needs to be offering something completely different and maybe trying to win perhaps more from the centre again. But as I said, given so many voters have left the Conservative Party for reform, the natural conclusion does appear to go after them. It just depends whether you believe that can be effective or whether those voters are simply lost now.
Yep. Robert Jenrick's point, to be fair to the man, he was using the wig as a prop because he wanted to talk about judges. He believes that some of them are compromised by their beliefs in open borders. Let's have a little listen to that bit.
Today I've uncovered dozens of judges with links to open borders charities who take to social media to broadcast their open borders views, who spent their whole careers fighting to keep illegal migrants in this country. Some even continue to do so whilst astonishingly serving as judges. It's like finding out halfway through a football match that the ref is actually a season ticket holder for the other side. The public rightly ask, how independent are they? They dishonour generations of independent jurists who came before them, and they undermine the people's trust in the law itself. Judges who blur the line between adjudication and activism can have no place in our justice system.
Well, that was Robert Jenrick speaking from the stage. We have to mention a bit of leaked audio from the man from, I think, yesterday. He was caught saying that he didn't see another white face during a visit to Birmingham. And he says he was making a point about a failure of people to integrate into their communities. Do you think it's a problem for the Tories? I mean, there are an awful lot of people who will think, yes, that is the kind of thing we're expecting Robert Jenrick to say these days.
Yeah, I mean, again, it didn't feel particularly like about judges or about justice. It felt like it was about immigration, and that is absolutely the pitch that the Conservatives, including Robert Jemrick, are playing on at the moment. And I think it is trying to address concerns of voters. You know, immigration has hugely increased in salience in the last year, but also in the last couple, really, ever since the pandemic. So, you know, it is an attempt to address voters' concerns with that. I think ultimately, though, from the Conservative point of view, it's not necessarily about a lack of policy, it's about a lack of trust that they could do anything about it. They didn't in government, and it's going to be really, really difficult for a party to regain that trust from opposition. But at the minute, it doesn't also feel like the Conservative Party are the main opposition to the government. It does feel like Reform UK are, and whilst you are trying to compete with Reform UK, who, you know, have no experience in government but can in theory say whatever they want, you are kind of fighting a bit of an uphill battle.
Chris, good to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed for your time this afternoon. Joining us live from the party conference, Chris Hopkins, Political Research Director at Savanta.
Some classic milling around going on in the background at the Tory conference. Our guest was there, and then behind him there were people with tote bags from the Centre for Policy
Studies. You must
come
away with many, many tote bags.
Yeah, and also it's that kind of indeterminate time of year. It's neither wet nor particularly cold, but people are carrying Macs around, and I've gratified there to see a lot of Macs at the Tory conference, but people are carrying them, not wearing
them. Do you find that a steadying image, Jane?
I do. I'd like to know that some things are staying the same. Now, coming up, the Spanish Tourist Board is encouraging Brits to consider destinations beyond the usual, so your Magalufs and your Ibizas. Our travel correspondent Ben Clatworthy will tell us exactly where the Spanish would like their British visitors to go. This is Jane and Fee on Times Radio. We're with Wickes, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
You searched for happiness, but society has its own expectation. You knew your desires, but duty stood in the way. You followed your heart to see where love could lead. And all the while, you were completing the spreadsheets. There's more to imagine when you listen. Discover new takes on timeless classics on Audible, like Becoming Meg Dashwood, narrated by Emma Thompson. Subscription required. See audible.co.uk for terms.
Growing a business takes a powerful team. People who think big, raise the bar, and smash expectations. People who are feeling at their best, not worried and waiting for healthcare. If you're ready to take your business to the next level, you need a team that's ready to deliver. Bupa helps your people to get health worries seen and sorted with fast access to expert advice, including GPs and physios. Your team will have fast help for muscle, bone, and joint problems, plus mental health services and cancer cover as standard, so they're ready for whatever life throws at them, at home and at work. Take your business further by building a happier, healthier and more motivated team. And as prevention is better than cure, your team will have access to our digital wellbeing services, including 1,500 gym classes, mindfulness programs and expert content. That's better for your team and better for your business. Get ready to power your growth with small business health insurance that powers your people. Let's get growing. Search Bupa Small Business.
It's another busy Sunday in the Thing household. Mr. Thing is leaf blowing. Ash is watching the footy. And the twins are power washing the cars. And everything else in sight. They're all making the most of half-price electricity from British Gas. Available every Sunday from 11am to 4pm with Peak Save. One of the ways we're taking care of things. Search British Gas half-price electricity to see what you could save. T's and C's apply, up to 60 kilowatts per session. Eligible tariff and smart meter required.
Listen to Times Radio at 6:30 every weekday morning for your indispensable briefing on the latest politics, business and sports news of the day.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms, helping create rooms to feel proud of. From design consultants who'll measure your space and bring your vision to life on a 3D plan, through to a professional installation service. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
25 past two, here's Mike, who says, Jane Fee, opponents of the triple lock have no real understanding of growing old in the UK today. Wealthy pensioners are a small minority. The remainder are on a low-level fixed income with no possible way of increasing it. Leave the triple lock alone and focus instead on working fit and able benefit, on working fit and age benefit recipients who are unjustifiably exploiting the state's generosity.
I think you also just have to consider a cross-party, long-term pension change committee, which just throws it into, what should we say, 30 years down the line.
And thinks the unthinkable.
We are going to have changed it by then. These are the things that we all agree on. It's just got to go.
Yeah, I'm sure I've mentioned it before, but I talked to a demographer, must be getting on for 15 years ago, who told me that the first person to live to be 120 in the UK was already alive, and that isn't going to change. There'll be more and more of us, if we're fortunate, living longer and longer. And where are we going to get the resources from?
Well, exactly. We so it's aren't. Not something that's going to go away. It doesn't go, to go away depending on your political hue.
No.
So it just needs sorting.
These are so difficult, though, these questions. If you do have a view, and I totally understand why Mike is saying what he's saying, 0333 003 2353. And in fact, the reasons he states that was exactly why the Tories brought in the triple lock in the first place, to help those poorer pensioners with no means, as Mike says, of increasing their income. Let us know what you think. Benidorm no more. Well, a new ad campaign from the Spanish National Tourist Board is encouraging British tourists to explore well beyond the well-trodden paths of places like Barcelona or the Balearic Islands. Presumably that's a relief for those used to refereeing wars over sunbeds, as depicted on all those shows about Brits abroad.
Oh, sorry, love. These sunbeds belong to someone.
There are no towels here. These are free.
I've just told you they're not free. Oi, what do you think you're doing? I've just said these are our sunbeds.
Did you just touch me?
I just want our sunbeds back.
Come on.
Right.
No.
No.
Well, we have all been there, let's just be honest. Ben Clatworthy is the Times transport and travel correspondent. I should have said that was from the TV show Benidorm, that clip. Ben is in Spain. Ben, where are you exactly?
I am standing next to the front line of Tower Wars in a hotel in Magaluf.
OK. Is it warm enough to be worrying about your towel in Magaluf?
Yes, it is. I'm standing outside. It's lovely weather, but the amount of alcohol that I'm seeing being consumed on said sun loungers, I don't think any of these people need to worry about living till 120, I have to say.
What time of day is it there? Is it 3:30 there?
Yes, just an hour ahead. Okay. It's beautiful sunshine. I'm honestly standing under a palm tree talking to you. There's a lovely breeze. There's people jet skiing out in the bay. There's someone on a banana boat that I can see at the moment. And there are some children that are sort of dive bombing into the pool that's in a funny shape because that's what hotels like doing.
Okay, and without being pompous, shouldn't those children be in school? But anyway...
Well, they probably pay the £60 fine to have the cheaper weeks, which is why I'm here now, basically.
Right. This is a serious issue, I guess, on behalf of the Spanish Tourist Board. Some parts of Spain, we know, have just had enough of tourism. Is that how this initiative started?
Yes, it is. So what the Spanish Tourist Board are trying to do is to say to holidaymakers, you know Spain, you love Spain, and the British Tourist Board and the Spanish Tourist Board work hand in hand, the ambassador and so on. What they're trying to say is, we know you love Spain, but basically 80% of British people go to one of five regions in Spain, which includes the Canaries and the Balearics, but also the Costas down the Mediterranean coast. And what they're saying is, we love having you, but is there any chance that you could try and spread out? And they're also saying to those people that are doing exactly what I'm watching them do, which is I'm standing in a suit, but they're you know, in sun lounging here and are probably on holidays where you land at an airport, there is someone with a sign with your holiday company on it who take you in a bus, drop you, deposit you at a hotel, and the next time you leave the vicinity of that area is to go back to the airport. What they're then saying is, while here, why not go up into the hills, visit a vineyard, go and visit a town, go to an olive oil growing family that are sort of, and what they're asking is whether people can go and do other things while they're here.
Okay, I mean, the sort of implication there, Ben, is that the average British tourist is a bit, shall we say, lacking in curiosity.
Well, I think there is an argument for that. But then Steve Heapy, the chief executive of Jet2, who've gone viral this year for everyone loves a Jet2 holiday, he was saying this morning to me that they also need to be relatively careful because companies like him fly an awful lot of people into their resorts and, you know, around this hotel, there are hundreds and hundreds of staff. And companies like his put thousands of people in here every summer and their jobs rely on them. And if they feel that the rhetoric is changing, they don't want to be here. And he gave Morocco as an example that some British people have already been put off by the anti-tourism protests in the Balearics are going, well, we could go somewhere else. Tunisia obviously did have its issue with the terrible atrocity on the beach. But people are looking at Morocco, for example, saying there's no anti-tourism protest there. And he's saying you've got to be very careful that you don't offend a core clientele. And with that, the airlines that bring them in and basically prop up an economy where here 90% of people are either directly or indirectly employed by tourism.
So very briefly, Ben, have you spoken to anyone there who dislikes this tourist board initiative?
Yes, we were speaking to a taxi driver the other day who said this year has actually been his worst year for takings. And in Magaluf, they've done a big drive to get the hotels more up market, sort of taking 2- and 3-star hotels into 4- and 5-star hotels. And they're saying that they're not the taxi driver. And it was only one taxi driver I was speaking to, but said this is the year that he has made the least money. While the deputy mayor of the area said to me yesterday while walking up the stairs in a hilltop town that she's delighted with the way the clientele that are coming to a town like Magaluf have changed.
Okay, very interesting. Thank you very much. Ben Clatworthy, the Times transport and travel correspondent.
A quick one in from Sophie says, we've just come back from a week in Zaragoza, 90 minutes from Barcelona. Absolutely beautiful. Not an English voice to be heard. Great tapas, historic buildings. So still Spain, but just much nicer. Sophie came from Sunbury. Coming up, what is quantum tunnelling? Why has it won a Nobel Prize? And Emma Raducanu suffers an unexpected setback in China. We'll check in with that too. James Kitchen has the headlines.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you, Fee. Good afternoon. Sir Keir Starmer's condemned protests against the war in Gaza taking place at several UK universities this afternoon. The Prime Minister's called the demos on the second anniversary of the October 7th Hamas attacks un-British. Meanwhile, the families of hostages being held in Gaza are demanding an apology from Israel's Prime Minister. It's after Benjamin Netanyahu said 46 captives are still in the strip rather than 48. Israeli and Hamas negotiators are meeting in Egypt to try to reach a peace deal. The Israeli opposition leader, Yair Lapid, says an agreement is vital.
A war that is going nowhere, hostages that are slowly dying, and of course the suffering Gaza that everybody in his right mind cares about. Children should not die in grown-ups' wars. So for everybody's sake, we pray for this to end.
Elsewhere, the Shadow Justice Secretary has pledged to crack down on pro-migrant judges. Speaking at the Conservative Party conference, Robert Jenrick claimed dozens of judges have links to open border charities. 46 people have been arrested by police in London in what's been described as the UK's biggest ever crackdown on phone theft. Officers say they've disrupted a network suspected of smuggling 40,000 devices from the UK to China in the last year. And in sport, Emma Raducanu's out of the Wuhan Open tennis after retiring in her first round match with America's Anne Lee. The Brit was 6-1, 4-1 down when she decided to withdraw. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
This is Times Radio.
Life's like a photo album. Mine bring back so many memories. That's a street party on VE Day. Me, 3 years old. Oh, here's me, 17, teddy boy. Our wedding. Didn't my Shirley look lovely? Holiday in Devon when the boys were small. They tower over me now. Oh, now these are the more recent ones on my phone. Oh, that's me and Kate enjoying a game of cards. She's my care professional from home instead. Kind, funny and very good at gin rummy. Since Shirley passed away, Kate comes to the house most days to help with the things I can't manage so well now. She's great company. I mean, the boys visit me most weekends, but they can't be here all the time. So home instead have really helped. I have the best quality care, but in my own home, from Kate. She's wonderful. Though she will have to let me win at cards now and again.
For award-winning home care you can trust, go to homeinstead.co.uk.
Hi, I'm Sam, colleague at Asda Hayes. It's hard to find a midweek dinner the whole family can agree on, but a classic cottage pie always hits the spot in my house, especially when it's a great price.
That's right, Sam. And Asda have got this 7.5-kilogram bag of potatoes from £4.10 rolled back to just £3. And this Asda beef and pork mince 750-gram pack for only £4.88.
That's easiest cottage pie. That's good honest value.
That's Asda price. Selected stores subject to availability. Potatoes excludes Northern Ireland. May exclude Asda Express and small stores. See asda.com/small stores.
Get the day's politics, business and sport every weekday in breakfast from 6:30 a.m.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms. Ready to start your next home project? This autumn at Wix, there are great kitchen and bathroom offers available. Explore the ranges at wix.co.uk or visit the showroom in your local Wix store.
John Pienaar has hot-footed it back from Manchester. He is on at 4 o'clock this afternoon. What have you got?
So, well, October the 7th, talking and reflecting on October the 7th exactly as you would expect. And, well, it means a lot. It would mean more if October the 7th was the day, or, you know, building up to the day, when there's some sort of a peace agreement in Gaza. And I keep talking to people who know a lot more about the subject than I do, with a great deal more experience, infinitely more than I do, who are sounding quite optimistic about that. But there are still lots of reasons why it may not happen. So I'm going to be just talking about that and just trying to get some sort of assessment of where it's going, in as far as that's even remotely possible at this stage. Talking to a family member of one of those who were murdered on October the 7th, 2 years ago. The body was taken back to Gaza, and just get that to that level, just sort of slight cross-section of the opinion among hostage families. I'm going to be talking about the Conservative Party, talking to James Carter, he's the Shadow Defence Secretary, and talking about Robert Jenrick. It wasn't something that he said actually in Manchester, but he said it a while ago, but it's a topic that he was walking through a neighbourhood in Birmingham, no one else was white, and that made him feel uncomfortable. He concluded that it wasn't integrated, and I just want to test that and challenge that a little bit. I'm going to be doing that too. It was reminiscent to me. It brought back a memory of Enoch Powell, who I can remember saying in one of his speeches that there were parts of the country, neighbourhoods, which were no longer part of Britain, except that they were situated in Britain. And it sounded like an echo of that Powell-like sentiment from Robert Jenrick. We'll see what James Cartledge has to say.
John, thank you very much. John is here from 4 o'clock this afternoon.
Go on.
No, you go.
OK, it's Linda in Bristol. She says, reference the triple lock. While I can sympathise with the revising it, considering means testing the basic state pension is a very different matter. Most recipients have worked between 30 and 40 years paying in to receive this basic benefit. It would now be criminal to say it should be withheld. That's from Linda. But I think when you pay your national insurance, you are actually paying not your own pension, but the pension of people currently getting pensions. That's right, isn't it?
Well, it is. And I suppose the argument, Linda, is not that something would be rescinded. It's just that there would be a plan in future to take away one of those parts of the triple lock. So it's not that you'd be taking back money from people. It's just that they might not get as much of a rise as is currently guaranteed. But just as soon as you start talking about pensions, you're into controversial territory, because somebody's not going to get as much as they had hoped.
I'd hope.
That is always going to hurt.
And it remains the case, as one of our earlier contributors said, some pensioners are properly up against it financially. But we also need to be absolutely honest about the fact that many are not. And some young people are properly having a tough time.
Voice
of today's lecture.
Voice of truth.
Thank you, Sarah, whoever that is.
In the corner. Right, is it me now?
Yes, carry
okay.
on.
The Nobel Prize in Physics has been awarded to a trio of American, French and British scientists for their work in quantum mechanics. Their experiments in quantum tunnelling have paved the way for the next generation of quantum technology. The Times' science writer and special correspondent Tom Whipple is here to try and explain what all of this means. Now, I've said with apparent confidence there the word quantum three times. I've mentioned quantum mechanics, quantum tunnelling and quantum technology. What am I talking about, Tom?
I would be suspicious of most people if they said they understood it. And I certainly don't. And I studied it at university for 3 years. Quantum mechanics is deeply strange. The aspect that they were looking at is this idea of quantum tunnelling. If you take an individual particle, it doesn't really exist in a sense in a particular space. It exists as a probability spectrum of different places it can exist in. And the edge of that spectrum can be the other side of a wall. And what that actually means is that it can suddenly pop up having apparently tunnelled through a wall. I mean, using wall slightly euphemistically, because it has to be quite small wall. And this phenomenon, quantum tunnelling, is still a true quantum effect in that it's completely barking and utterly counterintuitive. What the team has won for today is for showing that this effect can be seen in big things as well. Normally, little things, atoms do their crazy stuff, but by the time they get to the sort of size you can see them, you don't see quantum effects. And in fact, this is what Schrödinger's cat is about, this famous Schrödinger's cat experiment where Schrödinger posited this cat that would be both alive and dead at the same time until he opened the box and looked at it. And it was a way of him showing that you should be able to extrapolate really small and mad quantum behaviour to really big things, but then you end up with equally mad stuff, which is a cat that is simultaneously alive and dead. But they've got a version of the alive and dead cat, and they've rightly got the Nobel Prize for it. It's not a cat. It is a super cool circuit containing a Josephson junction. But this is a circuit that behaves, in a sense, as a single atom, in that it behaves in quantum fashion. It absorbs energy in distinct quanta, it jumps between states, it does all sorts of odd things, and these sort of pseudo-atoms have become the basis of some quantum computers, which are going to be the next great revolution in computing.
Right, thank God for people like you, Tom. and you studied this at university.
I know enough to sound plausible-ish over a short period of time.
You're with two humanities graduates in the studio here, so can you put all of that into a context that we might be able to better understand by using an example of how these incredible scientists will put something into our world using that incredible expertise that makes our world better?
Well, quantum computers, and these are happening, and they are computers that exploit very strange quantum effects to do kinds of computing that are literally impossible with classical computers like the one in front of you. One of the things that they're going to be very good at is modelling what atoms do, because they're using the phenomena that atoms have, and that means they should be able to design far better drugs, which are all about interactions at subatomic levels. The great hope for them is that they will be a way of really improving pharmaceuticals. But can I talk to you about the most important Nobel thing, which is who they got on the phone and how?
Yes.
So yesterday we left you with a cliffhanger, which is they hadn't managed to contact two of the laureates. By yesterday evening, they still hadn't contacted one of them, because it turned out he'd gone on a hiking holiday with his wife and he hadn't got his phone on and he hadn't been in reception. When they finally reached reception, 12 hours after he had become a Nobel laureate, his wife's phone pinged into action and she got 200 text messages from friends, and she shouted to him, "You've won the Nobel." And he said, "I haven't." But then it turned out he has. So Fred Ramsdell has been found. He was in the middle of the day. There was a point where he couldn't be found, and his company that he now works for simply released a statement saying that he is off hiking and living his best life. For this Nobel Prize, they did manage to get one of the researchers on the phone, a British researcher, John Clark, who's based at UC Berkeley, and he was on the phone at sort of 3 a.m. California time, talking about how happy he was.
Excellent. Well, I'm glad he's happy, because we have unearthed the moment that Doris Lessing found out that she had won the prize for literature in 2007. And it is quite legendary, because she was a little bit underwhelmed by it.
Have you heard the news?
No.
You've won the Nobel Prize for Literature.
Oh,
crap. How do you feel?
Good. Well, it's been going on now for 30 years. One can get more excited. Well, I'm trying to think of something really suitable to say. What do you think I should say? Look, you tell me what to say and I'll say it. Okay?
Isn't that fantastic?
I love her.
And also, for a writer with such a big independent brain to be asking somebody, you tell me, I'll just say it for you.
Now that is British.
It certainly is. And you're going to be bringing us all of these delights throughout the week, aren't you, Tom? These are really important moments for the world and for these individuals.
They are. They're brilliant. And it's lovely, because it brings sort of, you know, obscure science suddenly out from beyond the scientific community, and you've got this sort of imprimatur, you've won the Oscars of Science. Yeah, we will be here tomorrow for chemistry, and then you'll have to get someone else for literature and peace, because I don't do peace or books.
Okay, well, we'll do that ourselves.
You're our sort of guy.
Lovely to see you. That is our special correspondent, Tom Whipple.
Yes, somebody's just WhatsApped, "What just happened?" I think that was in reference to Tom's, I thought, expert explanation of what exactly they'd won the prize for. I think it's brilliant that we're celebrating these scientific triumphs this week. These people have mega brains, and we should honour them. We really should. But nothing will beat Doris Lessing with the sound of the cab in the background. She's got...
Oh, Christ.
Have a look. She's got loads of shopping. She's just oh, not this. Not now. Right, a bit of tennis for you. Emma Raducanu has had another rather unceremonious exit from an important tennis tournament. The British number one had to have her blood pressure checked before retiring from the Wuhan Open in China. Lisa O'Sullivan is somebody who knows, as you will know by now, everything about tennis. She's very much our number one tennis correspondent. So what do we know about what's gone on here? Was it particularly hot, Lisa?
Yes, I don't go all the way down to the quantum level. I will point that out. She is. There's been a lot of talk of the conditions in the Chinese swing of the tennis, and there have been lots of withdrawals from various tournaments. But it was, I think the temperature was around 31 degrees and the humidity was about 67%. So she was playing the American Chinese player, Ann Lee, and was 6-4, 4-1 down when she called time. But she was struggling for most of the match, to be honest. And, you know, she tried the old get the banana out and get some more fluids in and stuff like that. But she just, conditions defeated her. And Yeah, it was a real shame because she's been playing some great tennis, but we've seen Jannik Sinner go out recently against Hallen Grigsbor because, again, the conditions were just too much for him as well. So it's a really weird setup that they go over to China at the time where it's really humid, it's really uncomfortable, and they're playing ridiculously long matches.
Yeah. Is there any way they could prepare for these matches in such grueling conditions?
I think this is the conversation that both tours need to have. The tennis players are playing too much tennis, and we're getting to the end of the season. So we've had all four Grand Slams. We've just had the Laver Cup and the Billie Jean King Cup. We're heading towards the end of season finals, which where the top 10 players will be. So the best players who are effectively getting to the finals are playing more tennis than anyone else because that's the way it works, which means they're getting to this end of the season. If they're not injured or feeling absolutely wiped out by it, we saw a very moving, I think it was a social media post from Daria Kazatkina recently about saying that as players and often as women, they turn around and say, yeah, I'm fine. And she said, well, we don't mean it. And she's given this brilliant thing about why she's stepping down for the rest of the year, because she's not. She's absolutely wiped out by life on tour. You forget that when they're not playing, it's not as though they can sit back and, you know, rehab or go back and see family. From her point of view, she hasn't seen her family for 4 years because she is Russian or was Russian. She's now lives in Australia and hasn't been able to go back to Russia to see her parents because she disagrees and has disagreed with Putin very publicly. So she's got all of that. She is on tour and travelling like all the rest of them, from one hotel to another, from one tennis court to another across the year, trying to then acclimatise yourself to the conditions at the end of the year for what is a very lucrative time of the year when your body is very, very tired. You've done all the highs and lows of the slams and you've been through everything throughout the year to try and push through to when the season starts again before the turn of the year, because it's just after Christmas that we see the new tennis season year begin. It's a lot to ask for. And we're hearing more and more from both top and well, all the players, but it's the top ones that have the microphones that we listen to, who are saying that it's just too much, that they're absolutely wiped out by the schedules. And I think for the good of the game, there needs to be a little more consideration about actually keeping players fresh and keeping players playing all the way through to the end of the season.
Well, let's hope that the tennis authorities do make some changes. You make it sound so, so grueling. A quick word on Jack Draper, who's been ruled out for the rest of the season. Now, he's hurt his arm, but then we were told actually he might make a comeback of some sort.
Yeah, so he actually made the decision to end his season a little bit early because we saw him playing at the US Open and it wasn't 100% right. And there was a lot of discussion at the time about whether he was turning up in New York because he'd become the face of this new clothing. I'm not going to give him money. They're not asking
me to.
And they're not paying me to say it, and I can't even remember what that is anyway. But he was the poster boy all the way around New York for this new brand. And he played, and he clearly wasn't 100% well from this bruised elbow bone, this bruised bone, which just hasn't got better. So he decided to end his season, start the rehab. We think he's going to play potentially in an exhibition match in December. So that will be the first that we'll see of him. And then that is effectively when the season begins again. Some players get the opportunity. Carlos Alcaraz has taken off some of these Chinese matches. We saw him at a wedding having a lovely time. We saw him have a rest after the French Open by going to Ibiza for a few days. And of course, you know, he played brilliantly at Wimbledon, not well enough to beat Jannik Sinner, but it's management. So Jack Draper making a very good decision to take time off to actually fix a problem in his body. Hopefully that means that we'll see whether it's good when we have this exhibition match in December. Failing that, he'll be back looking to recover the ranking points he's lost, because he's going to drop out of the world's top 10 as a result, and then restart his season and rebuild again. But, you know, he's young, he's brilliant, and he's been very, very clever about how to manage his physicality and his body. And, you know, looking great, just needs to make sure that all the mechanics are working properly.
Lovely. Thank you very much indeed for your time. Lisa O'Sullivan, tennis expert.
Coming up, have you been to your local pharmacist expecting a free COVID jab only to be told you're not eligible? We're going to talk about that with our resident GP, Rachel Ward, next. You're listening to Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
John Pienaar on Times Radio Drive with Barclays Corporate Banking. This afternoon from 4, join John Pienaar for well-informed debate, insight and analysis that brings the big political picture sharply into focus. From global events on the international stage to issues closer to home. John Pienaar on Times Radio Drive with Barclays Corporate Banking. See tomorrow clearly with Big Picture Banking from Barclays. Find out more at barclayscorporate.com/thetimes.
Listen to Times Radio on your smart speaker. Just say, play Times Radio.
Amazon Prime Big Deal Days are here. 2 days of big deals on electronics, home, kitchen and more that'll make you feel less like and more like feel like a big deal. Amazon Prime Big Deal Days are the 7th and 8th of October, exclusively for Prime members. Shop now.
Stayshore. What is Stayshore? Stayshore is not just the UK's favourite travel insurance. Stayshore is the confidence that comes with knowing that you're covered by the company with more 5-star reviews on Trustpilot than any other provider. A company that welcomes people of all ages with pre-existing medical conditions for single or multiple trips. So Stayshore with Stayshore Travel Insurance. UK's favourite relates to number of 5-star Trustpilot reviews, T's and C's and verifications at stayshore.co.uk/reviews.
Here's the truth about AI. AI is only as powerful as the platform it's built into. ServiceNow puts AI to work for people across your business, removing friction and frustration for your employees, supercharging productivity for your developers, providing intelligent tools for your service agents to make customers happier. All built into a single platform you can use right now. That's why the world works with ServiceNow. Visit servicenow.com/UK/AI for people.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
So our listeners are such a fantastic bunch of intelligent people, and incoming today from Sarah is a Nobel joke. Here we go.
Go on.
Before a Nobel laureate has been told they've won, have they perhaps both won and not won at the same time? Is it Schrodinger's laureate? Isn't that wonderful?
You're too good for us, Sarah.
You are, and it's great. Pharmacists are having to deal with angry patients who've booked in for a COVID jab, only to find out that they're not actually eligible. The age limit has been raised to over 75s unless you have a weakened immune system or you live in a care home for older adults. Let's talk this through with our resident GP, Dr. Rachel Ward. Rachel, why has the age limit been raised? And actually raised by quite a lot.
Good afternoon. Yeah, well, of course, each year there needs to be a risk assessment of what strains of COVID are around, what the current kind of levels of disease are, and what our immune system is dealing with, and, you know, how much the virus has changed. And then there has to be a calculation as to which groups should be targeted to get the best benefit of this vaccination rollout. So you're right. And I think it's probably confused people as well, because, of course, this has been one of those things that's constantly changed. The flu vaccine criteria has also changed, because if you remember, during COVID, we were vaccinating anybody over 50. That's gone back up to 65. So it is really difficult to kind of monitor where we're at. But it is very clear, if you look on the NHS website or if you try and book a vaccine, what the eligibility criteria are.
Presumably, though, Rachel, lots of people are booking the vaccine and they haven't read that front page at their pharmacist. They've just got straight to the booking page. So it is the pharmacists who are on the receiving end of, you know, some very fed up people.
Yeah, apparently kind of up to 50% of people who have booked do not actually meet criteria, which obviously is very time consuming for the pharmacists who are having to explain that they can't have a jab. They are getting some abuse from people who want the jab, but it's also stopping people who need it to book in. But I mean, there is so much irony in this situation when I think how much chasing we do for people to try and get people booked in for the vaccines that we want them to have. But then the ones that they're not having, that they're booking into. So to some extent, you kind of have to laugh with this. But, you know, please do read the criteria before you book an appointment.
Absolutely. Very solid advice there. Next, it doesn't seem as though the UK is going to introduce routine screening for prostate cancer. Now, this is despite a lot of campaigners, and some of them welterweight celebrity campaigners, pleading for more checks. So what's your take on this?
Yeah, so the National Screening Committee are reviewing any evidence for various tests that we have for prostate cancer and working out, reviewing whether there is any evidence to show that we have an adequate test for screening. Now, screening is such a complex thing. If you have a test that you're going to roll out for screening, it has to meet multiple criteria. It has to be shown to be able to detect the disease early. It has to have what we call a high positive predictive value. So if it comes up as a positive test, it has to really be able to correlate well with the disease being present. And unfortunately, we just don't have a good test for prostate cancer. The problem is, if you start rolling out a test which has consequences, which is not good enough, what you end up with is harm to people who otherwise wouldn't have had investigations or treatments. So that's what this committee will be looking at. They will be looking at very complex statistics, trying to work out that benefit-harm ratio of have we got a test that meets the criteria. And the kind of predicted outcome is that they will say that we currently don't, which is obviously very concerning. And it always has been a problem with prostate cancer, but we just don't have the great tests available for screening.
Right. A very quick word, if you can, on hundreds of doctors in the UK who are treating patients without actually being verified by the GMC. How's that happened?
So there was a change of rules during COVID where people were being licensed with a lot fewer checks than normal. And essentially, there has been a legacy effect where people were registered during COVID and then that backlog of doctors have not then been appropriately, there's not been an appropriate catch up of verifying their identity. This has been identified by the Times as part of the investigation for doctors who are working in the UK have been banned elsewhere. So another very concerning fact that has been found that the GMC have not carried out correctly.
Right. That's something that we're going to carry on talking about, I think. Thank you very much indeed. Dr. Rachel Ward is our resident GP and co-host of the Pharmacy Podcast. I've been corrected on my use of boxing terminology by Simon. Welterweight, that's only middleweight. So I should have gone for heavyweight. In my defence, welterweight and heavyweight have been involved in the PSA campaign, but I think I'm splitting hairs now.
Well, I would say you're a flyweight.
Thank you. It's the nicest thing you've ever said.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
It's 3 o'clock. Good afternoon. Times Radio, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover until four. And in the next hour of the programme, it's the anniversary of the Hamas attack on Israel. We'll hear from a British man whose sister and nieces were killed on October the 7th and whose brother-in-law was held hostage. And our big guest is Elizabeth Day, podcaster and novelist. Here's the news at three, James Kitchen.
Thank you, Jane. Good afternoon. Sirens have sounded in Tel Aviv to mark 2 years since the October 7th attacks, in which 1,200 Israelis were killed and 251 others taken hostage. Indirect talks between Israel and Hamas aimed at securing a deal to end the war in Gaza are continuing in Egypt. The US President Donald Trump told reporters that tremendous progress is being made. But speaking to Times Radio, the foreign affairs expert Tim Marshall warned there are immediate diplomatic obstacles to overcome, especially when it comes to Israeli troops withdrawing.
If you look at a map that's in the 20-point plan, there's three lines in it in colour. Blue one is where the Israelis are at the moment. The yellow is the one that they will fall back to, the position they'll fall back to. It's only about 2 miles from where they are now. Hamas are going to say, we can't gather the 48 hostages within the 72 hours with you so close to us. We want longer and we want you to move further back quicker.
Meanwhile, more than a dozen protests against the conflict in Gaza are taking place at UK universities this afternoon. Sir Starmer has urged students not to attend the rallies, calling them un-British. The Prime Minister warned too many previous demos have turned into forums for hate and anti-Semitism. The Shadow Justice Secretary has promised to abolish the sentencing council if the Conservatives win power at the next general election. Speaking at the party's conference in Manchester, Robert Jenrick also pledged to crack down on what he called a pro-migration bias in the judiciary by sacking judges involved in political activism. The political research director at Savanta, Chris Hopkins, says the message was more about immigration than the justice system.
It is an attempt to address voters' concerns with that. I think ultimately, though, from the Conservative point of view, it's not necessarily about a lack of policy, it's about a lack of trust that they could do anything about it. They didn't in government, and it's going to be really, really difficult for a party to regain that trust from opposition. But at the minute, it doesn't also feel like the Conservative Party are the main opposition to the government. It does feel like Reform UK are, and whilst you are trying to compete with Reform UK, who, you know, have no experience in government but can in theory say whatever they want, you are kind of fighting a bit of an uphill battle.
It comes as Nigel Farage claims the Conservative Party is finished after 20 of its councillors defected to Reform. The Tories still have more than 4,000 councillors, while Reform has fewer than 900. The Times columnist Fraser Nelson says the party is divided over how to respond to Reform's success in the polls.
Broadly speaking, I think there's a split between those who do and don't want a pact with Reform. And Kemi Badenoch is saying that hell will freeze over before she does any sort of deal with Nigel Farage, that they're pretenders, socialists, the enemy. Robert Jenrick seemed to be the guy who, if he were put in charge, probably would do a deal with Farage. One of the nicknames I've heard for him here is Nigel's Chancellor.
And at least three people have been injured after a building partly collapsed in central Madrid. It's understood one construction worker who was working on the project to turn it into a hotel is in a serious condition in hospital. Emergency services using drones and sniffer dogs to check if anyone's still trapped inside. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on the Times radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms.
Good afternoon. Now, there are some signals today coming out of those peace talks between Hamas and Israel, perhaps hints at some sort of progress. Well, let's hope so. But of course, today our thoughts are very much with what happened on this day 2 years ago when Hamas terrorists entered Israel and killed about 1,200 people. 250 others were taken hostage. Steve Brisley's sister Leanne and his nieces Noya and Yahel were killed that day. His brother-in-law, Eli Sharabi, was one of those taken hostage. Eli was released earlier this year, and you'll hear a little bit about how he is in the next couple of minutes. Steve has been telling me that this time of year is always extremely emotional for the whole family.
Last week would have been my late niece's 15th and 18th birthdays. They were murdered in the original Hamas attack. But our mission at the moment is to get the hostages home, including the body of Eli's brother. And it's that we're trying to focus on at the moment. But it does have to be mixed up with all the pain and loss that we've experienced.
Are you able to go through exactly what happened to your family on October the 7th?
My sister Leanne, Eli Sharabi, her husband, and their teenage daughters, Noya, who was 16, and Yahel, who was 13, were in their house on Kibbutz Be'eri, about 2 or 3 miles from the Gaza border. They went into their missile room when the alarms went off. They heard news from around friends and family on the kibbutz that terrorists had infiltrated and were killing people. And soon enough, their house was broken into by a collection of terrorists who dragged Eli out and took him to Gaza, leaving Leanne and the girls alive in the house when Eli was taken. But at some point shortly thereafter, Leanne, Noor and Yahel were murdered with automatic gunfire. And Eli ultimately spent 491 days in captivity in the Hamas terror tunnels without knowing that the life he'd left behind, the family he'd left behind, was gone. And he only found out that his wife and children had been murdered when he was released on the 8th of February this year.
Do you know who told him?
Yes, he was collected from Gaza by the Red Cross and then taken to a rendezvous point. And it was when he got into the army transport that a social worker who was there to accompany him told him that his mother and sister were waiting for him at the base. And Ellie obviously said, I need to see Leanne and the girls first. And at that point, the social worker said, your mum and sister will tell you. And he said at that point, he knew that that meant that Leanne and the girls had been killed. And so that's how he found out, in an army truck driving the last few kilometres from Gaza into Israel.
And he'd got through his incarceration, as I suppose we all would, by thinking about his family and about memories and positive thoughts about them. So this is unimaginably painful, isn't it?
It was an absolutely crushing blow for him. Obviously, he came out on the 8th of February, but he was back on the 7th of October 2023. We'd had, 18 months to come to terms with our loss, but he was coming out to it fresh. Obviously, he'd considered the possibility that the Leanne girls had been taken hostage or had been killed. There was no reason to kill them. They posed no threat, but they were murdered in cold blood. And that's something that he has to sort of deal with emotionally now, that he wasn't able to protect them, as he says. But clearly, against armed terrorists, there was nothing that he could reasonably do. He would have perished with them as well had he tried to fight. So he's come back alive, and that's been a beacon of hope in all of this.
How is he now?
He's doing okay physically. He lost 4 stone in captivity, being starved by the terrorists, despite them having sufficient food. He was beaten. He had his ribs broken. They were humiliated and physically and psychologically abused. The physical scars are healing. He's put on a couple of stone and looks much more healthy. He's incredibly mentally strong, and he's basically turned his anguish into advocacy for the hostages. But he does say that he still feels that he is still in those terror tunnels until the hostages are home, including the likes of Alon Ohel, who he was held captive with and became something of a surrogate father figure, and Avinatan Orr, whose mother is British and with whom I've spent a lot of time campaigning for a release deal.
Are you, Steve, at all hopeful that the peace deal proposed by the Trump administration might bring about the return of hostages this week, possibly?
Well, hope is one of the things that Hamas has not stolen from us, and so we guard it with vigour. Our hope isn't naive. We've had too many false dawns so far. It's action and results that we've come to learn are important. So we're encouraged by what appears to be progress, but there always seems to be an and but from either side, whether it's Hamas or Israel. So there is a very, very long way to go between an announcement of a 20-point deal and actually seeing our loved ones return for dignified burials and return to their loving families.
How are you coping? Because particularly in the light of that horrific attack on the synagogue in Manchester last week, this feels like a pretty febrile time, actually, and I can only begin to imagine what hearing about that was like for you.
Well, in fact, me and Ellie had appeared at an event at the Heaton Park Synagogue at the end of June for him to tell his story and for us to give speeches to the community there. It made my blood run cold. It brings it all back. I'm not myself Jewish. Our family, British family, isn't Jewish. But we've been taken to the hearts of the Jewish community, who have stood with us in solidarity. And events like this are horrifying. But equally, I've seen in the news about an arson attack on a mosque. And it's that cycle of violence and that cycle of tit for tat that can't be allowed to carry on, whether that's in Israel and Gaza or on the streets of the UK.
Do you sense that, and I appreciate you've mentioned the attack on the mosque, but do you sense that anti-Semitism, is it on the rise again? And if so, what can you, as somebody who is adjacent to and very close to the Jewish community, do about it?
Well, I think what we've always tried to do is to make this about people, not about politics and religion, and to try and get people to remember that Leanne was a dental nurse, Noya and Yehel were just school children. And that's true of many of the innocent people who have been killed in Gaza as collateral damage in this war. So I try to remind people that we're talking about human beings here on both sides of the border in both religions. And that's the important thing to remember. But the experience of my friends and family who are in the Jewish community is very clear that they are fearful to show their Jewishness, whether that's by the way they dress or when they're going in and out of a synagogue. That can't be a civilized way for life to be.
And what about the suggestion that some students at some UK universities are planning pro-Palestine demonstrations on October the 7th?
It's always difficult for me to get too heavily involved in the politics of it. I don't have any problem with students expressing concern about the war, expressing concern about the loss of innocent lives in Palestine. I share concerns about the loss of innocent life, but I think too often these people are ill-informed about what exactly started this, about the terrorist attack on the 7th of October and the innocent people in Israel who have been killed. So I'd caution those that want to protest in any way, shape or form to first educate themselves about both sides of things and not look at this as a binary black and white issue. Too many of these protests completely miss the nuance.
Steve Brisley, a very, very impressive figure, talking about his sister Leanne and his teenage nieces Noya and Yahel, who lost their lives on October the 7th, 2 years ago. And also our very best wishes to his brother-in-law, Eli Sharabi, now released. He was taken hostage and somehow picking up the pieces of what remains of his life. Let's talk to Tal Schneider, political correspondent for The Times of Israel. Tal, first of all, how are things in Israel today and what is happening to mark the anniversary?
So it's a somber mood and lots of events taking place in you know, wide range communities around the border. And tonight there is the main event in Tel Aviv in a big arena marking 2 years. This event is organized by the people. Government was not taking part in that at all. Financed by donations only of the people and the families of the victims and the families of the wounded and people, many people who, I mean, the big group of people are the survivors and the victims of the Nova festival. The music festival was taking place that Saturday on the border. Their families are heavily involved in arranging events. I mean, this is like 350 people who were slaughtered there. So on the same place. So, I mean, lots of communities and lots of events to cover because, as you know, the terror attack took place in a region of around 100 kilometers wide all over the place. And many people in different communities were slaughtered or hurt or, you know, even people who saw with their eyes the terror attack got wounded in their souls.
Of course, yes, so much suffering on that day, and of course the suffering continues for so many. Is there, Tal, any sign of optimism in terms of the peace talks in Egypt? What are you hearing?
So, I mean, according to statements coming out from the President of the United States and from the Israeli Prime Minister, There is optimism. However, people have heard this in the past. This is maybe the first time that the Israeli government signed a paper that includes the words end of the war. So maybe this time around it's different than previous rounds. However, we don't know much about what's going on in Sharm el-Sheikh. We do know that Witikoff and Kushner left D.C. to come to the area and join them. Sharm el-Sheikh in Egypt, it's just an hour flight from here. So if the Israeli minister, Doron Dermer, will join them, it's just a very short flight. And I hope that, you know, the meaning of Kushner and Witkoff's arrival is for a conclusion. However, I don't know details. I mean, we probably heard that the Hamas terror organization doesn't agree to some of the terms, specifically maybe the way the IDF is going to be relocated at first, and then there is the relocation later on because they still need to protect the border and protect the Israeli communities from future attacks. During that day, by the way, we had four missiles coming in from Yemen. The Yemenites are, the Houthis, the terror organization financed by Iran, they are supporting the Hamas. So, and also there was two rockets today coming in from Gaza to Israel to mark the 2 years. Only two rockets, but I mean, they were intercepted, but still, we still have to protect this border.
Of course, but we also have to mention that Israel is still continuing its offensive in Gaza City, is it not?
Well, I'm sorry. They were supposed to halt all operations. From what we hear, I'm sorry, they are operating only where the terrorists are trying to attack Israel. They're not operating as far as I know, within the population. And as I said, there was two rockets coming in today from Gaza to Israel.
Thank you, Tal Schneider, political correspondent for The Times of Israel.
It's Jane and Fee at times.radio. We are also 0333 00332353 if you'd like to contact the programme. Coming up, we're going to talk to a listener in Norwich whose local area is awash with flags and embroiled in debates about them. You're listening to Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
Kate Borsay on Times Radio.
Former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak joins us as we mark 2 years on from the October the 7th Hamas terror attack. It is day three of the Conservative Party conference. It'll be assessed by Giles Dilnot, the editor of Conservative Home, and will be joined by Nadeem Zahawi, the former Conservative Chancellor. Conservative peer and former Health Minister Jim Bethel joins Michael Binion, the former diplomatic editor of The Times, to discuss the biggest stories of the day.
Kate Borsay, tonight from 7 on Times Radio.
Hey, business owners, the digital switchover is coming, and it's not just for business landlines. CCTV, payment systems and alarms could be affected. We urge you to switch to digital with BT by December 2025. You'll also benefit from faster connections, greater security and cost savings sooner. We'll help make the switch as smooth as possible, so you can spend more time doing what you do best, running your business. Start your switch to digital with BT today. BT Business is urging customers to migrate off the old PSTN by the end of 2025. The final closure date for PSTN is 31st of Jan 2027.
This is the sound of learning in India. A healthy dose of happiness in South Sudan. And a full tummy in Hertfordshire. Poverty, conflict and the climate crisis are hitting children hard. Save the Children operate in the UK and over 100 countries worldwide, helping the next generation to stay safe, healthy and learning. By leaving a gift in your will, you'll help fund our life-saving work, giving children around the world more reasons to laugh. Gifts in wills allow us to respond quickly when disaster strikes. They help us to deliver vital healthcare. They give children the chance to heal emotional wounds, to rebuild confidence, to laugh and smile again. At Save the Children, we believe childhood shouldn't just be survived, but enjoyed. And for us, nothing says success like this. Help to give children the best start in life by leaving a gift in your will. Search Save the Children, Gifts in Wills. Save the Children is a registered charity.
Here's the truth about AI. AI is only as powerful as the platform it's built into. ServiceNow puts AI to work for people across your business, removing friction and frustration for your employees, supercharging productivity for your developers, providing intelligent tools for your service agents to make customers happier. All built into a single platform you can use right now. That's why the world works with ServiceNow. Visit servicenow.com/UK/AI for people.
The Monopoly game at McDonald's is back. And with a 1 in 4 chance to win instantly on pack, you could get your hands on a £2,000 Jet 2 holiday, a Big Mac, Merlin annual passes for 4, and even more epic prizes. Go on, it's your go. 18 plus, UK, ends 21st of October. Selected menu items, subject to availability, app may be required. See mcdrules.co.uk.
Download the free Times Radio app and listen to us wherever you are.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms, helping create rooms to feel proud of. From design consultants who'll measure your space and bring your vision to life on a 3D plan through to a professional installation service. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
We're here for your Nobel Prize jokes this afternoon. Incoming from Dominic, a scarecrow has been awarded the Nobel Prize. He was outstanding in his field. Coming up, no, don't. We're here for them. Coming up after 3:30, the novelist and podcaster Elizabeth Day will join us as our big guest. We always have a big guest. And if you miss it, or maybe you just miss the end of it, or you got to go and do the school run, or you're having a little kip, you can catch up with it all over again on our podcast Off Air with Jane and Fee. You always get the 3:30 interviews. Recently, we've had Tim Spector, Lise Doucette, Ian McEwan, and recent topics on the podcast, solo travel for women, things you really don't want to hear Taylor Swift singing about, and Neolithic orgies. And that's because last week we spoke to historical fiction king Ken Follett. His new book imagines how Stonehenge was built. Now, this is the clip that we wanted yesterday. This is the clip we're going to give you today. He explained how he believes prehistoric people would introduce new DNA to their families.
Point is, yes. Just as they would bring bulls and rams from far away to mate with their herd to introduce what they would call new blood and we would call new DNA, they've realised it's actually quite sensible for the human beings as well.
Oh, I see what you mean. So it's an orgy that's bringing lots of people together.
It's an orgy with a point.
An orgy with a point. Well, let's trademark that. Off Air with Jane and Fee is our hit podcast. I'm just going to keep saying that, our hit podcast. It's available now wherever you get your podcasts from. Still the worst phrase in marketing history. And you might well enjoy it. It's more of a community than a podcast, really, and you'll be very, very welcome.
Now, we've had a summer of debate around the flag, with George crosses and Union flags adorning many communities. The flag wars continued to rumble on, the former England defender Gary Neville revealing he removed a Union Jack from one of his construction sites. Now, one of our off-air podcast listeners, Joanne, also contacted us about the tensions that flags have been causing in her community. She lives in Norwich. It's a multicultural area, a mosque, a gurdwara, an Asian and a Polish community. And one morning she woke up to find that a string of flags had been put up on lampposts all the way down her street. And on further investigation, some residents reported that they'd seen through their bedroom windows, and in some cases their kids' bedroom windows, men up ladders in the middle of the night, just a couple of feet away, putting these flags up. They hadn't asked the local residents, like Joanne, if they were happy for them to do this. And Joanne and quite a few of her neighbours felt that they were a disturbing presence, not benign symbols of patriotism at all. So they started to take them down, and this is where we join her story.
There was a lot of positive feedback to begin with, but as we've continued further down the road, things started to get a little bit more negative. And we started to get beeps from people saying, why are you taking it down? Are you English? Are you not patriotic? Get a job. You're a lefty scumbag. So there was a lot of kind of comments that were going on. And we got about as far down the road, probably about 17 flags down the road, if you want to measure it in flags. And we were outside a Tesco. And at that point, a group of women came up to us and they told us that they had bought the flags and that they were their flags and that they wanted them back. And of course, we were not up for getting into, you know, a big debate. We gave them back the flags, but we did say to them that we didn't agree with them going up. And there was a bit of a conversation there.
Right. And spool forward a little bit, because that was by no means the end of the story, was it? You created a community mural, mostly done by women and children in the area. What did the mural look like? What was on it?
Oh, so it's so brightly coloured, lots and lots of chalk drawings, messages of welcome, things talking about love and unity, saying, you know, Norwich is a place of sanctuary, no human is illegal, but also lots of hearts and depictions of love and unity, because we obviously realise that not everybody's going to understand English. So we wanted to really make it as welcoming as possible.
And where was that?
So that's not far from the mosque, about halfway down my road. And it's like a huge hoarding that's surrounding a building site. So it's like a black fence. So it was the perfect canvas for those kind of messages.
What then happened to the mural?
So, it took us a few hours to create this lovely mural. And it was, you know, it was metres and metres long. And later that evening, once darkness fell, the flaggers came back and defaced the mural. So they started to rub out the messages that children, women, and other community members had written. They scrawled EDL on it and RIP Charlie Kirk. They also, a woman, one of our community members who stayed to watch what was going on and to film it, they threatened and harassed her. And subsequently, two of them, a male and a female, were arrested for that incident.
Mm. What do you think this has done to the community, Joanne?
It's had a really interesting effect. So on one side, it has definitely solidified the community groups that were already there. And it's opened a lot of people's eyes to, I would say specifically white people's eyes, to the privilege that they already enjoy. And made them realise that actually you can feel alienated and ostracised in your own area, in your own street, and even in your own home. On the other hand, you know, we did have a huge group that was a response to the flags, but we sort of ended up arguing within ourselves about how we approach the flags. A lot of people wanted to reclaim them and put messages of love and unity on the flag itself. Others said, look, you know, asylum seekers and migrants aren't going to see those messages of love and unity within the flag. They will see the flag and think that it's just a continuation of that message from the far right or from the flaggers, whatever you want to call them.
Do you know who it is who is putting the flags up? But I mean, we're able to kind of trace people's movements now quite easily on Facebook groups, aren't we? And that's often where the rallying cries on both sides of the argument about flags are most visible. So can they find you and can you find them?
Well, I'm not big on social media, but we can certainly find them. And quite a lot of us have been tracking their movements on social media. So we can tell, for example, when they're planning to go to the asylum seeker hotel and shine their torches and laser pens at the migrants who are there. Well, for example, just about a week and a half ago, their social media was awash with threats to intimidate and harass residents in our area and any individuals who took down flags as well. So that was a very worrying time, and I ended up calling the police because I was a bit worried that somebody might approach my home.
And how do you get back within a community to a place where you can have a reasonable conversation about people who've got genuine concerns about migration but who aren't racist and don't want to use violence or intimidation as a method of expressing a view?
Well, I think it's a huge task, because I think it really goes right back to inequality, economic inequality and poverty and lack of jobs and housing and opportunities. It's not the fault of asylum seekers. And it's also not the fault of people who are feeling like maybe asylum seekers are in their area and they're feeling frightened. It's the fault of governments who have just failed to tackle educational disadvantage. They're allowing the rich to protect their wealth and keep it for themselves. So people like Nigel Farage and Stephen Yaxley Lennon, also known as Tommy Robinson, they know that. But they ask us to point the finger at people who are even worse off than us, because they know it lets the people who fund them and make them more powerful off the hook.
Sure. It is the point of friction of our times now in this country, isn't it, Joanne? And I wonder where you look to from politicians to hear a message that you want to hear, which I think all of our listeners can tell from the conversation we've had, is one of welcoming to people who you believe deserve to be here, wanting to live in a community that is unified, not divided. So who's sending out that message to you?
Quite honestly, I can't think of any political party or politician at a senior level who's doing that right now. Even Keir Starmer, you know, I voted for him. I thought he was fantastic, but he has so disappointed me in his approach to this. Rather than being the bigger person, rather than saying, you know, we need to welcome these people are desperate for our help, he's jumped on the bandwagon and he's tried to turn it around so that he's appealing to people with less welcoming views than trying to make them understand that we should all try and welcome these people, because they will enrich our community.
And what would you say to someone who's listened to all of this, Joanne, who says, you know, get your hands off our flag? What we are trying to do is to be patriotic, to see something in this country that we are proud of, to not be afraid to say that.
I have no problem with patriotism, but I think when you confuse patriotism with nationalism and a sense of nativism, is that the right term? I'm not sure. But a sense of only a certain group of people are allowed to show these flags and own these flags, well, then you've got a problem. You're not living in the 21st century, are you?
Mm. Do you feel fear, Joanne?
No. I'm not afraid for myself, but I am fearful for what society is becoming and where we're all going with this. I still have hope. I still have optimism that we can get past this really tricky stage in our history. But I think we are ignoring so much that's gone before. You know, even there are members of my community who remember the National Front in the 70s, and they say it's happening all over again. Have we learnt nothing? Have we learnt nothing from history?
Plenty of you have thoughts on this, and we'll get to as many...
I'm just reading. I've been described as somebody with a lefty worldview.
I know, it was me in the interview, not you.
I know, it's hurtful.
It's very hurtful.
On every level.
Anyway, we'll get to your thoughts in a moment. It's 0333 003 2353. Our big interview today is with the author and podcaster Elizabeth Day about her new novel. It is called One of Us. Let's get a check on the latest news headlines first with James Kitchen.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you, Pete. Good afternoon. Sir Keir Starmer's condemned student protests at universities on the second anniversary of the Hamas October 7th attacks, calling them un-British. The Prime Minister says too many previous demos have turned into forums for hate and anti-Semitism. There was also criticism of protests after the Manchester synagogue attack. The Conservative Party conference is taking place in the city, with the Shadow Home Secretary Chris Philp speaking earlier.
Those expressing extremism or anti-Semitism or racial or religious hatred of any kind, or support for terrorism, who are not British citizens, should be removed from this country, including those at the student marches today.
The Shadow Justice Secretary's defended comments he made earlier this year, which critics say stirred racial division. Robert Jenrick complained of not seeing another white face when he visited the Handsworth district of Birmingham. The European Union is planning to clamp down on British second homeowners who overstay on the continent. Brussels has told members they should rigidly enforce the 90 to 180-day rule and issue fines and bans to offenders once new biometric checks come into force next week. One of the killers of Stephen Lawrence has spoken for the first time about his involvement in the teenager's murder. David Norris has admitted punching the 18-year-old in southeast London in 1993. He's begged the victim's family for forgiveness at a parole hearing, but refused to reveal who stabbed him. And Jaguar Land Rover will begin the phased restart of manufacturing operations tomorrow following a major cyber attack at the end of August. The carmakers also announced a finance scheme for struggling suppliers. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
This is Times Radio.
When you're growing a small business, you need someone who understands the ins and outs. And whether you're a tailor or an accountant, you need the tools to succeed. With an HSBC Small Business Banking account, you'll have free accounting tools and access to our business specialists, virtually or in person. Because whatever your small business looks like, we're with you all the way. Search HSBC Small Business Banking account to get started. Subject to application, eligibility, credit check and T's and C's. Visit hsbc.co.uk for details.
The Monopoly game at McDonald's is back. Play today with the Philly Cheese Stack, so you can enjoy two beef patties, crispy grilled onions and a melted cheddar cheese sauce. Go on, it's your go. From 11 a.m. until the 21st of October, participating in restaurants, subject to availability, app may be required. 18 plus, UK, see mcdrules.co.uk.
Looking to grow your investments and generate a long-term income? The Scottish American Investment Company, also known as Saints, could help. Saints has been investing for over 150 years and focuses on growing capital as well as income by investing in a diverse range of companies from around the world.
Saints is managed by Bailey Gifford, manager for some of the UK's best-known investment trusts. Find out key information and more at baileygifford.com. As with any investment, capital is at risk and income is not guaranteed.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms. Ready to start your next home project? This autumn at Wickes, there are great kitchen and bathroom offers available. Explore the ranges at wickes.co.uk or visit the showroom in your local Wickes store.
Right, we're going to do one of each then on the subject of flags. Carol says, what a brilliantly articulate and thoughtful woman, just on Jane and Fee talking about nationalist flags. Can she be our PM, please? And this one from Robert. This Norwich flag woman is so typical of the leftist liberal group who see multiculturalism as some kind of utopia. It's not. Her comment that locals might not understand English speaks a thousand words.
Right, well, welcome to, what was it we were called the other day? Centrist grannies.
Yep, centrist grandland. That's us.
Yes,
with a left of centre bias.
We're owning it. Good afternoon.
Very good afternoon to you too. We welcome to the studio now one of life's great flops. It's Elizabeth Day. She's a maven of modern culture, writer, podcaster, clothes designer, friend addict, girl about town, ginger cat owner, and kind soul. Elizabeth's podcast, How to Fail, is one of the most successful in a very busy marketplace. Well-known guests pop along to share three failures with her. It is a massive hit. She's the author of four non-fiction books and five novels. And she's also known to many for sharing her fertility journey, often both physically and emotionally painful. And it was when she put her hope of motherhood to bed after a long road of treatments and hopes raised and dashed that she wrote her latest novel, which is called One of Us. It's a continuation of the story of lives she detailed in The Party, and it's already on the bestseller lists. Elizabeth, welcome to the studio. How are you?
I'm so much better after listening to that glorious introduction.
Well, every word of it is true.
Thank you. Yeah. I am a ginger cat owner.
Yes. Now, your ginger cat is called...
Huxley.
Yeah, he's gorgeous.
He is gorgeous, yes. A friend of mine who's not a cat person describes him as a sexy cat. And I think that that is deeply accurate. Jane is making a face.
Just, I mean, is he fat?
No.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
He's lean and muscular and athletic.
Right.
He's a bit on the podgy side.
I think he, to me, because I've only seen him on your Insta, but he looks like a fun-loving chubster.
It's like a character on Married at First Sight, who this series would describe himself like that.
Right, let's talk books.
Okay, let's do it.
So the main protagonists in One of Us are Martin and Ben and accompanying people around them.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit more about them and what has happened to them before we meet them in this book.
Yes. So as you so kindly said, One of Us is a companion piece to The Party, which came out in 2017, but you don't have to have read The Party. So The Party told the story of Martin Gilmore, who's a quintessential outsider. He had quite a rough childhood, got a scholarship to a boarding school, and there he became fixated with the aristocratic charming Ben Fitzmaurice. The two of them became best friends. Something happened during their university days where they fell out massively, and Martin is now hell-bent on revenge. So we meet them 7 years on from Ben's 40th birthday party, where all of this came to a head. Ben Fitzmaurice is now on course to become the next Tory Prime Minister, and Martin Gilmore is unexpectedly invited back into the Fitzmaurice family fold, and he thinks he wants to bring his former best friend down, but actually life has other plans. And interspersed with their voices, we also hear from some new characters. So Ben Fitzmaurice's wife, Serena, comes to the fore, and she's the first perimenopausal woman I've written whilst actually going through it myself. So she's someone who's grappling with a loss of identity and a loss of hot flushes. And there's Cosima, Ben and Serena's eldest daughter, who's an environmental activist, although neither of her parents knows. And that's quite awkward for Ben because he's energy minister. And then the final character is Richard Tate, who is a failed Tory MP. He's just lost his front bench seat for a workplace indiscretion.
He watched some porn at work.
He watched some porn on his work computer. But it wasn't quite tractor porn. That would have been too on the nose.
Right.
It was just your common or garden human porn. And he really wants to redeem himself in the public consciousness, so he decides to go on a reality TV show. Was it inspired by real life events? I couldn't possibly say.
Mm. Well, it is a delicious skewering of the establishment, which I loved reading about. And also, you do go there. I mean, I obviously take your point that none of these people represent real people in the real world who might sue at all. But they're close enough for us to recognise their foibles, their failings, their pompous nature. And I thought, well, good on you, because it's quite anti-establishment.
Thank you for saying that. And yes, there were a lot of things that I found made me a bit cross in our current day society. And one of the many things that makes me a bit cross is this assumption that we still seem to have, because we are so hidebound by class still, that people who have been privileged enough to come from money and an aristocratic background, who've been sent to an elite private boarding school and then seamlessly sail on to Oxbridge and then from there go straight into the Houses of Parliament, the electorate somehow still believes that they will have our best interests at heart and they're the experts at ruling because they come from this kind of ruling class. And sadly, historically, that has been shown recently anyway, again and again, not to be the case. And so really, One of Us is about why we fall in love with the people who damage us and why we sometimes elect them too. And it's about this recurrent theme of carelessness, I think, and sort of lack of empathy. But because I am someone who believes in the radical power of empathy, each of my characters, as unself-aware as they might be to begin with, as unlikable as they might seem, although they make decisions we might not agree with, by the end of the book, I hope that they have each, apart from one, redeemed themselves and the reader understands at least where their damage has come from.
I just wanted to ask about my favourite character is Richard Take.
Oh, mine too.
Yeah, who's taken down by his own silliness, Richard. You should have known better. But the reality show he then goes on to appear on hasn't yet been made. But you feel it could be. Now, I probably can't reference the title, although it's Something Happens! Exclamation mark.
Yes.
And it's a reality show that, I mean, I'm sure it's been discussed in commissioning meetings at television production companies. It takes celebrities and they become sewage workers.
Exactly.
Which, by the way, is an extremely important job. I mean, no way demeaning that. Where would we be without them?
Yeah.
I mean, you have to wonder how long it's going to take before that programme is properly made.
Well, you may already know this, but I am a huge fan of reality TV.
Yes.
And so it was a lot of fun inventing a format that hadn't yet come to our screens. And you make a very good point about sewage workers, that they are really necessary to the fabric of this country, as are so many people who do jobs like that that are not in the public eye, that are not glamorised. And I was interested in the tension between the two. The job that gets all of the public approval and attention, which is someone who's ruling the country, and the job that doesn't, but is the one that we all rely on. And what would happen when we put Richard Take in that situation and he gets showered with human excrement, quite literally.
But comes out rather well in the end.
He does. And this is where I was definitely inspired by real life events. And I was also inspired by something that Margaret Atwood told me when she came on How to Fail.
Name drop.
Just to let me pick that name up off the floor. when she wrote The Handmaid's Tale, which, as your listeners will know, is this dystopian novel set in the future, she didn't write anything that hadn't already happened or wasn't already happening in the world around her. And I wanted that to be the case in One of Us. So everything has a basis in reality. And we have all witnessed people who have made bad errors of judgment, sometimes in public office, somehow manage to inveigle their way back into public favour, because by doing a reality TV show and appearing on podcasts, they become familiar. So their bad behaviour becomes like a sort of lovable eccentricity almost, like a crazy uncle at a wedding.
I'm human, me.
Well, they hope, don't they? I mean, has anyone checked the Matt Hancock app recently?
I mean, I don't know, and I couldn't possibly comment, but we do live in a world where we've elected the former star of The Apprentice, President of the United States. And I think that's partly because the American voters became very used to him. They were just used to seeing him on their TV screens and used to kind of dismissing maybe his bad behaviour. It's just like, well, that's just Donald, isn't it? So I think I wanted to examine all of that. But one thing I would love your listeners to know is that I hope it's funny as well, the book.
Oh, it is funny. And one of the lines that Jane and I liked, both of us, enormously, was your takedown of a podcast that one of the characters is listening to featuring two men, one of whom is a junior prisons...
Well, former junior prisons minister,
telling us all what to do with our lives now. So we liked it very much indeed. And I really love your characterisation and your turn of phrase about people. I think that's what, for me, makes your writing really, really stand out. And I wonder whether you feel, and I hope you can answer this question honestly, whether your writing doesn't get the credit it should do because you are simply good at other things too.
Mm.
Do you ever think, you know, maybe if I was just a novelist, if I didn't have the Super Soiree successful podcast, etc., 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 people would take my writing more seriously?
I do. To be totally honest, I do. I think that we are quite bad or ill-practiced at allowing women in particular to be more than one thing in this country. And I have always loved writing books. It was my first ever passion. I've wanted to write books since the age of four. And that came first before the podcast. And I'm incredibly grateful for the success, ironically, of the How to Fail podcast, because it's brought me to a whole new audience. But then you encounter this other prejudice, which is that if your writing is in any way commercially successful, so you sell a few copies, then you're not taken seriously in a literary sense either. And I find it frustrating that we still live in a society where we're constantly put in boxes and where certain kinds of books get much more attention, and they are often written by men and read by men. And I'm sure all of your male listeners are absolutely lovely and this wouldn't apply to them, but there's been lots of research.
I've just seen some of the messages. They're not all that lovely.
There's been lots of research done that men tend to just read books written by other men. And I think the same thing happens in podcasting. And it's a constant source of frustration, because I'm not saying that I'm the best at everything, far from it, but I do endeavour to get better. And I do take my work very, very seriously. And I have now written 10 books. And I was lucky enough to have one of us called a State of the Nation novel, firstly by Fee Glover, it has to be said.
Who?
I know. and secondly by Marion Keyes, who I think is another great example of a terrific author who has never fully got her due as a writer's writer. She's had great commercial success, deservedly so. But women aren't normally given the credit of having written a State of the Nation novel. We're generally sort of pigeonholed as doing domestic dramas.
I agree with you about Marion. Both you and Marion, and other great female writers, and some men, write characters that I can invest in, that I recognise and that I care about. And that has got to be more important than anything else about fiction, surely.
I agree with you. I mean, I love character-driven fiction, and I am someone who writes from that perspective too. It's the character that informs the plot rather than the other way around. So sometimes stuff will happen in my books that I don't realise is going to happen at the outset because my character has done something I didn't expect. But I think the podcast really feeds into my fiction in so many ways, because ultimately I think One of Us is about the life that we think we are owed, or that my characters believe they're going to live, and the reality of life as it unfurls before them. And failure ultimately is the tension between those two states. And so it's very, I'm in a very lucky position where I get to ask amazing guests about times they failed in their life and what they learned from it. And so all of that goes into, I hope, my understanding of human nature. So it also feeds into it. But in answer to your question, Fee, I think, yes, women do get taken less seriously when they do more than one thing.
I mean, I did think very much when I was reading this book about Andrew O'Hagan's book, which is Caledonian Road, which is an amazing book and described as a State of the Nation book and very, very, very highly celebrated. And I'm just being honest about this. I couldn't get to the end of Caledonian Road. It didn't hold me. I really loved the characters, the conceit of it. You know, it's about a successful man who can't quite move into the new sphere of digitalization and social media. So there's a huge play on that. But it just didn't have that kind of empathy. It didn't make me laugh. And I think there is quite a comparison between the way that that is received and the way that maybe your books are received too. But I don't want to throw shade on him. He's a magnificent writer.
He's great. I haven't read Caledonian Road, but I have read lots of his books, and it's an honour to be compared to him, even in the same breath. Interestingly, he's just written a book called On Friendship, and my previous book was called Friendaholic, which was also about friendship. So you can do a direct compare and contrast there too.
We certainly can.
Actually, I don't know if this is too sort of deep to get into, but I do think there's this assumption that if a book is somehow challenging to read or hard to get into, that it must be too clever for us, so therefore it must be good. And ultimately, I never forget that my primary role is to entertain and engage a reader. I mean, they're always front and centre of my mind.
Yeah, and so they should be. I mean, you know, Jane and I would agree on this. You know, that's what makes us keep reading, is exactly that kind of sentiment. Do you ever worry about your books not ageing well? We were talking about Jilly Cooper's books, and we were celebrating her amazing success. But it's an absolute truth, and, you know, one that she would admit herself, that some of the stuff that she wrote earlier on in her career, so 30 years ago, doesn't quite stand the test of modern scrutiny in the way that women's bodies are described, in the way that the male gaze is described. Do you have to really think about that now, to write a book for eternity that will offend nobody ever on this planet or another?
Well, first of all, just want to pay tribute to Dame Jilly Cooper, who did so much in terms of her skewering of class and social mores and the writing of transgressive sex. And she was a huge influence on me, and it's so sad that she died in the way that she did. I don't worry about writing a book for all eternity. I worry about writing a book for the reader now, actually. And if it stands the test of time, then that's wonderful, but it's really nothing to do with me. That's up to the other people who choose to pick it up and do me the honour of reading it. And actually, I have a lot of time for novels that are of their time. So I love an interwar novel written by an underrated female novelist. And Persephone Books do a great job about bringing those women to the fore. I really like sort of period pieces. So if my novel is one of those, that's fine. I am aware of shifting cultural tides. And because ultimately I believe storytelling, when it's done well, is an act of empathy and inclusion, I don't want to offend anyone willfully, absolutely not. And I do want to ensure that my books, if they are set in current day society, are representative of the people who live in that society. So I'm aware of all of that, but not at the cost of a good story.
This book, One of Us, is the second of, I'm guessing, a trilogy. We're certainly left on a little bit of a cliffhanger. So is there going to be more?
I do love a grouping of three. That sounded rather...
Back to Ken Follett, briefly.
Rather edgy.
So we'll clip that for the trail, love.
Yes. Oh, well, funnily enough, when I wrote The Party, I didn't think I'd write another one. Mm. But clearly my subconscious had other plans, because I did leave the ending rather open. And then I just thought The Party had a political backdrop that was rooted in sort of David Cameron, Theresa May era. And so much had changed in the interim that I wanted to see sort of what those characters were up to now. And I've left this one deliberately open because I do think I want to return to it. And I do think it will be a trilogy, but I'm not returning to it immediately.
I've got a question from Helen, and you'll be able to understand why this is important to Helen. Is your guest a ginger cat owner or a ginger cat owner? Or is she a ginger cat owner?
Oh, got it. Yeah. This is why your listeners are the best. My cat is Ginger.
Yes.
And I would describe myself as his owner, and he would laugh at that description, because really he owns me.
Yes, but you're not yourself a redhead.
I'm not myself a redhead, no.
Right, there we go, Helen. I hope that has solved all your issues this afternoon. Appreciate it.
You took your slightly cynical view of psychics to see a psychic, didn't you, called Alexia, with extraordinary results. And I was intrigued to read that. I'm a cynic of psychics myself, but she really seemed to pull something out of the hat for you.
Yes, it was an incredible experience. And I should preface this by saying, if this kind of belief system is not for you, that's completely fine. I'm not trying to convert you, but all I can tell you is what happened to me. I was going through a really difficult time because of that fertility journey that you outlined in the introduction. I'd had 12 years sort of trying and failing to have babies, fertility treatment, recurrent miscarriage. And then my partner and I had tried via egg donation and then that had failed. And I really felt at a low ebb and very confused as to what to do next. And a friend of mine who had also been through fertility struggles mentioned a psychic. And I, because I was feeling so confused and so lost, I was sort of flailing and reaching out for anything that might be able to help me. And so I sort of grabbed hold of this. I was like, oh, could I get her number? And she said, yes, of course. And this psychic, who I'll call Alexia, it's not her real name, but she is based in America. And my friend said, text her to make the appointment. Don't tell her your name if you don't want to. And she just arranges to call you on the phone. So she didn't even see my face. So I texted her to arrange the appointment. I said my name was Elizabeth, but I didn't give a surname. And she called me on a Wednesday evening in February at 7 p.m. And the first thing she said was, is Elizabeth your real name? I said, yes. She said, okay, well, you love words. And that's the first thing she said. And I thought, gosh, that really does go to the root of who I am. I do. I so love words. And she went on in this way for about 30 minutes, saying things that were absolutely bang on, like my husband's name, what he did for a living. My mother had neck pain. I checked later. She'd put her neck out while bell ringing. And then she said, I know you're a writer. She's like, I know you're a writer, but do you do something else? Are you a kind of life coach helping people through their mistakes? Which obviously is hilarious because I do have this podcast, which is all about failure. I said, well, no, not quite, but it makes sense. And then she said, I feel like you're grappling with a lifelong desire and whether to let go of it right now. And if it's to do with children, I firmly believe that you were a mother of six in a past life and it almost melted you. And this life has been offered to you to live on your own terms. And if that resonates with you, I can promise you, you're going to have a big life. It's going to be full of happiness and meaning and great holidays with friends. And when she said that, the number six really resonated with me, because when I thought about it, I'd had three miscarriages and three failed rounds of fertility treatment. So I'd technically been pregnant six times. And when she told me that, it gave me a permission that I'd been seeking. And I suddenly felt totally at peace and completely aligned with this being my purpose.
I read your piece that you wrote about that and I got all the tingles. And I am a cynical person about that type of stuff, but I just thought, wow. Wow.
I'm very grateful to her.
It is really lovely to have you in the studio. Thank you for coming along. One of Us by Elizabeth Day is out now. It's a hard recommend from me.
And indeed from me. Thank you, Elizabeth.
Thank
nice
you.
To see you.
This is Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
The Times at 1. Every Monday to Thursday afternoon, listen to Times Radio for an agenda-setting one-hour programme hosted by the best talent from the Times and Sunday Times newsroom. Tackling the big talking points with the lunchtime menu of the latest news and the sharpest analysis. The Times at 1, every Monday to Thursday afternoon from 1. On Times Radio, with Standard Life. Working towards better retirements for all. Find out more at standardlife.co.uk.
Download the free Times Radio app from the App Store or Google Play today.
The Monopoly game at McDonald's is back. And with a 1-in-4 chance to win instantly on pack, you could get your hands on a £2,000 Jet 2 holiday, a Big Mac, Merlin annual passes for four, and even more epic prizes. Go on, it's your go. 18 plus, UK, ends 21st of October. Selected menu items, subject to availability. App may be required. See mcdrules.co.uk.
Stayshore. What is Stayshore? Stayshore is not just the UK's favourite travel insurance. Stayshore is the confidence that comes with knowing that you're covered by the company with more five-star reviews on Trustpilot than any other provider. A company that welcomes people of all ages with pre-existing medical conditions for single or multiple trips. So Stayshore with Stayshore Travel Insurance. UK's favourite relates to number of five-star Trustpilot reviews, T's and C's and verifications at stayshore.co.uk/reviews.
Here's the truth about AI. AI is only as powerful as the platform it's built into. ServiceNow puts AI to work for people across your business, removing friction and frustration for your employees, supercharging productivity for your developers, providing intelligent tools for your service agents to make customers happier, all built into a single platform you can use right now. That's why the world works with ServiceNow. Visit servicenow.com/UK/AI for people.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
So that is the book that we both honestly really, really loved. It's One of Us by Elizabeth Day, and it is very much available now. Now, tomorrow, I think we've got another great guest. Who is it, Fee?
I don't know.
I'm almost certain it's Joanna Lumley. That went better in rehearsal. It's Joanna Lumley. And then on Thursday, we've got another brilliant novelist, actually. I can't believe our luck this week. It's Anne Cleves.
Excellent.
Yeah.
It is quite a lineup.
Yeah. It is. So thank you very much for listening. If indeed you have, if you've turned on thinking we're somebody else or you're waiting for something else, then I'm not that bothered about you. But to the lovely messages we've had, thank you, Anne, for yours. And thank you, Minnie, for yours as well. Both really enjoyed the chat with Elizabeth Day. Our producer was Rosie Cutler, and our technical operator, Ryan Boyden. And John Pienaar is next with Drive. Have a good late afternoon and evening. We're back tomorrow.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
I'm John Pienaar with Drive on Times Radio. Thanks for joining me. Now, the news today on the headlines. Events are being held in Israel to commemorate 2 years since the October the 7th attacks. And in the UK, more than a dozen pro-Palestinian protests are taking place at UK universities this afternoon. And coming up, as the second anniversary of October the 7th comes, with the backdrop of those peace talks in Egypt, throughout the programme we'll be looking at how they are progressing or not with people at the heart of that story, including a man whose cousin was abducted and killed 2 years ago today. And I'll be asking the Metropolitan Police how they were able to dismantle the most significant stolen phone network in history.
This is Times Radio.
And now the news with James Kitchen.
Thank you, John. Good afternoon. Events are being held in Israel 2 years since Hamas killed 1,200 people and took 251 hostages. Negotiating teams from both sides are continuing talks in Egypt to try to end the conflict in Gaza, which has been ongoing since October the 7th, 2023. The US President Donald Trump has told reporters that tremendous progress is being made. The Times' World Affairs editor Catherine Philp, who's in Jerusalem, says Israelis are not necessarily united on this day.
There is even a split within the hostage families themselves about whether the military response to Hamas is the correct one or not. But I will say that the majority of the hostages' families are calling for an immediate end and a ceasefire. And those calls are very live still in Tel Aviv, where there is a mixture of solemnity but also protest.
Meanwhile, more than a dozen protests against the conflict are taking place at UK universities this afternoon. Sir Keir Starmer has urged students not to attend the rallies, calling them un-British. The Prime Minister warned too many previous demos have turned into forums for hate and anti-Semitism. The European Union is planning to clamp down on British second homeowners who overstay on the continent. Brussels has told members they should rigidly enforce the rules and issues fines and bans to offenders once new biometric checks come into force next week. Under the post-Brexit agreement, those without the right to work or reside in the EU or a member state passport can only spend 90 days in a rolling 180-day period in the bloc. The Justice Secretary, David Lammy, has accused his Conservative counterpart of attacking British values over plans for ministers to appoint judges. Robert Jenrick also promised to abolish the Sentencing Council if his party returns to power. He's been speaking at the Conservative conference in Manchester.
Let's fight for a better future. Let's build this new order. Let's take our country back. Thank you, conference. Thank you.
Mr. Lammy says the independence of judges is not optional. Meanwhile, Nigel Farage claims the Conservative Party is finished after 20 of its councillors defected to Reform UK. The Tories still have more than 4,000 councillors, while Reform has fewer than 900. Speaking to Times Radio, the Shadow Scotland Secretary, Andrew Bowie, insisted the party is looking forward.
I fundamentally believe that these few days in Manchester are sowing the seeds of our recovery. We are rebuilding to a point of strength, and we are ready to fight and indeed win the next general election when it comes. So I bid them farewell. It is with sadness that I do so. I think they're wrong, but we move on.
It comes as Nigel Farage has described his fear after an Afghan migrant allegedly threatened to shoot him while preparing to cross the channel in a small boat. Speaking in court, the Reform Party leader said it was clear that Fayez Khan planned to kill him in the threats made in a TikTok video. Khan denies making a threat, intending that the MP would fear it would be carried out. And the Crown Prosecution Service says it will challenge the decision to drop a terrorism charge against NICAP's Liam Ohani. The 27-year-old rapper was accused of displaying a flag in support of Hezbollah at a gig in London last November. The case was thrown out at Woolwich Crown Court last month because of a technical error. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB, online, and on your smart speaker.
John Pienaar on Times Radio Drive with Barclays Corporate Banking.
Hello, I'm John Pienaar with Drive on Times Radio. Thanks for joining me. Today, October the 7th, we focus on Gaza, the pain of the loved ones of the hostages still held by Hamas, the hope of those families and all people of goodwill that the Gaza peace talks in Egypt might yield a deal. But first, some remarkable, worrying news is breaking just as we come on air. The European Commission is about to announce a huge increase in steel imports into the EU, an effective 50% import tax on British steel sold into Europe. And that is the UK's biggest market for overseas steel sales. Now, to appreciate the scale and significance of this sudden development, and a formal announcement is expected in the next 15 to 20 minutes or so, it is being seen now within the steel industry as a potentially existential threat, far, far greater than the impact of the steel tariffs imposed by President Donald Trump. It means a risk to jobs, a risk to production. It means a risk to the steel industry of this country itself. Does it also mean an outbreak of trade war between the United Kingdom and the EU, just as the government has been trying to improve relations? So, as I say, this story is breaking now. We're expecting a formal news of this this coming new policy, maybe in the next quarter of an hour or so, and we'll be brought right up to date with this story by Ollie Wright, the policy editor of The Times. So do stay with us. Now, first of all, as I was saying, it is, of course, October the 7th, and that date conjures thoughts of the worst horrors of our human species, the worst that we as people can perform. 9/11 is another such date, and it will be that way for generations, and so, of course, it should be. It's also the day that calculated the unspeakable murder and abduction by Hamas of hundreds of Jews innocently enjoying a music festival, the date that marked the start of the Israeli military onslaught on Gaza that has killed tens of thousands of innocent Palestinian men, women and children. And it's not a pure coincidence that delegations from Israel, Hamas and the United States are together in Sharm el-Sheikh in Egypt today, trying to talk through a deal to end the killing, to release the hostages, and at least in theory point the way towards a permanent peace and a two-state solution in the Middle East. And when I say it's not a pure coincidence, that's because Donald Trump is known to have wanted to see a deal in time for today's two-year anniversary of the October the 7th outrage. President Trump is fond of such symbolism, just as he is fond of the idea of being awarded a Nobel Peace Prize. So today on the programme, I will get you up to date with the commemorations in Israel of that awful day 2 years ago, and with the debate here as students at a number of university campuses stage pro-Palestinian protests. And despite Keir Starmer calling those protests on this day un-British. I wonder, do you agree with that, by the way? Send me a text, send me a tweet, and we'll be assessing the prospects for the peace talks in Egypt in as far as that is possible. We'll also be hearing about the plans drawn up by